Hello and welcome to the Inquiry Teacher podcast. I'm your host, Matt Fletcher. I'm on a personal journey of self-discovery, seeking to uncover the secrets of becoming an inspiring educator. In each episode, I'll be joined by experienced educators who excel in their fields, engaging in conversations that touch on a wide range of topics. We'll explore the strategies, stories, and insights that can help all of us on the path to becoming better educators. But that's not all. We're not just looking at the past, we're also keeping our gaze firmly on the future of education. That's why I'll be sitting down with entrepreneurs from the ever-evolving world of EdTech. Together, we'll delve into innovative solutions and trends that are shaping the classroom of tomorrow. Whether you're a teacher, a student, a parent, or simply passionate about education, then this podcast is for you. So join me on this exciting journey as we unravel the mysteries of teaching and learning. The Inquiry Teacher podcast is here to inspire, inform, and empower you on your own educational quest. On this episode of the Inquiry Teacher podcast, I'm joined by the incredible Jessica Vance, an educator, leader, and author of the book, Leading with a Lens of Inquiry. Join us as we embark on a captivating conversation where we'll explore her inspiring work, uncover invaluable tips and advice for new teachers, diving into the world of inquiry-based learning, and discover the secrets to crafting those awe-inspiring, jaw-dropping learning walls that take classrooms to the next level. Okay, all right. Welcome, Jessica, to the Inquiry Teacher podcast. It's great to have you on. How are you doing today?
I'm really great. Thank you so much, Matt, for having me. Getting to connect faces off of social media is always really special, so thank you.
Yeah, great. All right, well, can we start a little bit with just if you could let the listeners know how you got into inquiry-based teaching and where did your journey begin?
Yeah, so I fell into it actually, maybe about 15 years ago, after a big move, got hired at an IB school. Well, they were an IB school who was in their candidacy phase. So got hired with the promises of this is just good teaching, this is best practice, and not even knowing what that meant. Formerly was at a very traditional private school, and so a different approach to teaching and learning. And so fell into inquiry through the IB and have loved it ever since. Of course, have expanded my knowledge about inquiry, stepping outside of the IB school, to be honest. But yeah, it's been really a great journey for sure. Yeah, so I was a classroom teacher at the time and learned about inquiry through the program, of course, and then just really appreciated the honestly the ambiguity and the depth and complexity of what inquiry brings. And I feel like it was a snowball effect after that, getting introduced to, of course, great minds like Kath Murdoch and Kimberly Mitchell. Just kind of delving more into what does inquiry look like and sound like. So many other educators, not published authors, have blogs, just as yourself, different online resources. So I was able to look at what inquiry looked like and sounded like in their practice. And so eventually got to step outside of the classroom and facilitate a program of inquiry at a different IB school. So yeah, it's been quite a journey.
Great, yeah. So how... when you started within the IB program, how did that inquiry cycle process look like, and did it adapt over time from when you gained more experience and worked with other people?
Yeah, so I think just like anyone who is new to inquiry, you just want to know all the things and how does it work and what do I do first and then what second and third and fourth. And of course, as you know, as an experienced IB teacher, inquiry teacher rather, that's not how it works. And so what I found was really helpful was the inquiry cycle and using that as a frame of understanding the what, the why, and the how of what I was doing within the classroom and how we were unpacking the central idea. So I'd say Kath Murdoch's inquiry cycle was really pivotal for me to really use as something that I felt comfort in. And then I'd say once I found a little bit more comfort in that, just started really finding a passion in learners' questions and leaning into those. And how do you use learner questions to be able to drive your next steps? So I'd say those were two tools, if you will, that I definitely held on really tightly to. And once I stepped out of the classroom into the role of an IB coordinator, realized, of course, there is so much more beyond that. Mm-hmm. And provocations got kind of folded into that as well. I believe at that time I got introduced to Trevor McKenzie's work and so got to do a book study with my staff and just kind of unpack what does inquiry look like and sound like. I write about this a little bit in my publication, actually, about the lack of transfer of what we knew was best practice or what IB said, but actually what was happening in the classroom and how there was definitely a disconnect between the two. And it was becoming really tricky and challenging to be able to embody that inquiry mindset, even as our knowledge and understanding of what inquiry looks like and sounds like grew as a staff and it grew in myself as an educator. There was definitely a disconnect. And so leaning and leading with a lens of inquiry became, I think, something quite transformational, not only in my practice, but I think those who I got to lead and learn alongside.
Yeah, right. And we'll touch on your book a bit more because I read it recently and it was a really great read. And one of the things, you know, I wanted to kind of ask you a bit more is from shifting into leadership, what are perhaps some of the common struggles that new teachers face when starting out with inquiry-based learning that perhaps you wish you could have, you know, known yourself when you were starting out, which could have perhaps sped up the way in which you were effective using this kind of methodology and idea in your classroom?
Yeah, you know, I have always had really fantastic and phenomenal leaders within the many different inquiry settings, especially when I first fell into inquiry. And I think they were learning about inquiry themselves, to be honest. And so when I was told, well, this is just best practice, or you have to have students tell you or show you where to go, it was too ambiguous for me. And there was a really big how gap. And so I'd say having some freedom to, of course, be a little bit confused or kind of sort on my own is definitely really important. And I'm so glad that they didn't tell me all the things to do. I'm glad that they kind of let me flounder a little bit and be confused and ask a lot of questions, because I ended up finding my way in a manner that was most meaningful to me. But I was definitely missing the how. So I'd say if I were to talk to, and I do all the time, teachers who are new to inquiry, I love to start with something really tangible, which are provocations. Of course, it's different than an engage of a 5E model or that anticipatory set of a traditional 7-step lesson plan. It's an intentionality around purpose and experience, and then how are we evidencing and artifacting what that is and using that to drive our next step. So I'd say that is something that I see begin to start to turn on the light, if you will, to take those first steps with inquiry. And there's really actually, Matt, three questions that I've been asking myself and asking others who I coach or facilitate professional learning sessions around. And I wish that my leaders at the time asked me these as succinctly, and they probably did. And maybe I just wasn't ready for it. Right. Mm-hmm. The first being, where in the learning is there space for collaboration, right? Number one, how are our learners turning and talking and me not being the sage on the stage? The second one being, where is there space or how might I leverage different types of structures or protocols or opportunities to co-construct what learning looks like and sounds like, right? So of course, provocations come in there. I think about thinking routines, gathering learner questions, right? So there's a little bit of an ebb and a flow and a give and take of how it is that we co-construct understanding together. And then I'd say the third, Matt, is where are we capturing evidence of thinking and wonder? And I'm a really big fan of learning walls as of late and share a lot about those. But that evidencing piece to me is really critical and huge, not only so our learners can retrieve and reflect and think about their thinking, but so that we have something that's really rich and meaningful when we are opening up our laptops or taking a look at our curriculum and seeing how things might layer or marry a little bit more seamlessly than perhaps I felt when I was first diving into inquiry.
Yeah, some really wonderful things to share there. And you share some really great stuff about provocations on your Instagram as well. So could you kind of share with the listeners, like, what would be the checklist of like a good provocation to use in the class? Do you have any, you know, top tips or anything you look for when selecting a provocation?
Yes. There's so many things. There's, first and foremost, I think it's asking ourselves what our learners might ask about what it is that we're putting forth, whether we have a grouping of artifacts or we're showing a series of videos or a collection of photos or bringing up something to read. I think first grounding yourself and asking what might our students ask or think about this thing that we're putting out there. Sometimes we get really excited about something we're excited about, and then we don't pause to think how our learners might take this in. It only takes a moment to do so. And I've been guilty of it too, thinking about this really amazing provocation and then realizing that it didn't land because it's not necessarily a step in thinking that I had given myself space to do so. I am a really big fan of the Google extension Pocket. And I guess it works a little bit like Pinterest, but it's different, where you can add it as an extension and then you can give whatever resource tags. So let's say I see a really cool TED Talk kind of come across my social media feed. I can pocket it, if you will, and tag it a bunch of different things. So, you know, maybe I have a unit that is centered on the concept of perspective, or maybe I know I have a unit on sustainability, or it's a math provocation. Any kind of topic or concept that I can think about, I will tag it as that. And so when I'm designing provocations, I'll go to my pocket and take a look at the different types of tags that I've had and created. And those are usually a wheelhouse of some different types of tools that I can pull from. Some other favorites, of course, picture books are huge. Lots of educators are big fans of picture books. But I have a hack that I'd love to share that I learned from another educator, which I just think is so genius. She said, Jess, if I don't have time to read the book, what I'll do when I'm in the library is I'll just scan the spines of what's in the library. Maybe her kids are working on something else. And if the title alone is thought-provoking, she'll grab that. And that could be something, just the cover and the title could be a provocation for what it is that are going to unpack. So maybe what's inside is maybe too higher level or maybe not just developmentally appropriate. But I love her thinking outside the box of a title or a cover as being something that is thought provoking. It makes me think of the thinking routine headlines from Project Zero's work as well. I could go on and on, to be honest. You could, but those are some that just kind of come to mind. They're a little bit outside the box.
I think I'll link that Google Pockets onto the show notes as well, because I haven't heard of that before. So
you're going to love it.
Yeah, that'll be a great tool there. So there's one thing you mentioned in your book that you do with your teams, and that's that you don't really set a pre-planned agenda for professional development. And you like to co-design and co-create. And I was just wondering, how has that changed the teacher's approach to professional development? I mean, it's something that we try to do in the classroom with students by
co-designing and creating those rubrics and assessments, but how has it worked with other teachers about getting the best out of them during those sessions?
Yeah, so, you know, there's of course a continuum of what co-designing could look like and sound like, right? The one that I mentioned in my publication is actually for a cohort of teachers who are newer to our campus. So we carve out some budget and time to be able to have some just extended time to learn alongside one another. I'd say typically the first one has a provocation with some general frames in mind, right? What does it mean to teach with a lens of inquiry? Of course, wanting to learn more about them. And then really designing learning experiences to gather that data. So utilizing some thinking routines, taking a look at the evidence. And then from there, the co-design comes into play. So funny that you're asking this question, because we have another meeting with this very cohort coming up in a couple of weeks. And it's been some time since I met with them last. And so I've honestly very casually just asked them, hey, we're meeting together in a couple of weeks. Like, I'm really curious. Is there some things that you want to unpack? So I can have those really casual conversations with them, and they can give me very direct feedback, which of course makes it really easy for co-design. But also I'd say the key is to being in classrooms and being in around the school helps me co-design, because I can pick up and notice and name the things that I know are skills that they can continue to flex and to develop. So for example, the first session, we unpacked different types of provocations and thinking routines. And then I found out that one of the teachers tried something and it didn't go as she planned. So this is now going to be something that I bring up, not to point her out, but to lift up as an opportunity for us to get really interrogative and curious about what happens when we have a provocation or use a thinking routine and it doesn't land. What do we do next? Or where do we go wrong? Or what might we do differently? So really being in the learning with learners, just like you are as a teacher, tuning in and listening as students are working on projects, is critical and key for co-design. Of course, just as you mentioned, and you probably do within your own practice, asking for feedback in the form of surveys that are a little bit more formal. I'm a big fan of compass points as well, as being a really great tool to gather some data as well.
Yeah, it's that, you know, the collaboration that you instill, you know, can run through the whole school. Then it can run through the classroom, it runs through the staff and the team and the professional development. And I think it's a really great, you know, skill to be able to share with others, but also develop in and out, and to kind of, you know, because inquiry-based learning is hard to kind of define, really, isn't it? It looks like so many different things, and having that collaboration with colleagues and talking about it and discussing it and being open about what you need to improve and to work on together, I think is a really powerful, powerful feeling to have in a school building.
Yeah. And, you know, Matt, it just makes me think of probably what you do with your students in your classroom. Is we think about the skills that our learners have and those that maybe are a little bit more of a stretch. So when I ask new staff who've never engaged in inquiry, what do you want to learn about? Sometimes that's really hard because they've never been asked that before. And so providing a menu or giving some options is a really great way to kind of scaffold what that can look like and sound like. And then also gives them a structure or frame of mind to work around and about.
What are some things do you think that we can do to best prepare teachers and students for getting ready to join in this inquiry-based learning classroom?
To get ready, I'd say I always go back to the learner and ask them. I think that is helping them get ready by flipping or turning a traditional classroom or system on its head and not being the first one to say what it is that we have to go do. And again, being okay to sit in the silence and know that your learners or teachers might not necessarily be able to give you some feedback quite yet. But that's really, to me, such rich, valuable evidence and data of, okay, they're not ready yet, so let's build some relationships together. We can build relationships through some collaborative structures, right? And just as I outlined before, inquiry is collaboration. So can I be really intentional and mindful about creating spaces for collaboration? So that way my learners know that it's not going to be a one-sided conversation. It truly is a space where all voices are valued and wanted and leveraged and utilized. So I'd say, you know, the collaboration piece is huge. Getting feedback is huge. And know if you have some leaders who are listening to this right now that sometimes the feedback that we get, it doesn't really give us a lot of direction right away. And so being in the spaces, less like I said before, and kind of seeing what skills or there's a community that a district, sorry, rather that I'm working with in Northwestern Canada, BDEC, they serve a community of an Indigenous community. And what I love is that they don't say, what are your skills? They say, what are your gifts and talents that you bring? And I just love how that is so much honoring of the different things, whether or not we've had inquiry experience or not, we can bring to the table. And it's our job as inquiry leaders and teachers to listen and look for those gifts. And how might we leverage them and invite them and have them add value to the programs and schools that we are nurturing these spaces of inquiry in?
What I want to move on to talk about a little bit now is something that I know that a lot of listeners are interested in, and it's the learning walls and the learning spaces that you have in the classroom. Mm-hmm. For those listeners who perhaps don't really know what a learning wall is or looks like in the inquiry-based classroom, could you explain a little bit about what they are and how valuable they are for, because I see you do it in your you have like staff learning walls as well as in classroom ones as well, so you know, what are the benefits that you see from taking this approach to like classroom display boards?
Yeah, so I'm currently actually working on this publication now. And funny enough, when I started writing last July, I was talking to my middle schooler, and he was formerly at the school that I'm at right now. And I had asked him, he was asking what I was writing about, and I told him, and I said, what would you define, or how would you say this wall is, or what is a learning wall? And he said, it's an improvement to a wall. And I really love that simplicity, right? Again, from our students is always say it best. It's an improvement to the wall where, and this is, of course, Reggio Emilia background and research. So this is nothing new necessarily, but really space is our third teacher. And how do we leverage our walls or third teachers to be able to empower what it is that we're doing in the classroom and to be able to support our students and provide an equitable space for all students to enter in on the learning. So, you know, as a former IB teacher, I had my quote unquote IB wall with my central idea and lines of inquiry, and I thought it was doing the thing. And when I think back now to that wall, it was just another bulletin board. Nobody was using it besides me. I was checking the box, if you will, of what IB said you probably should have. But I wasn't really leveraging it to support the learners or the learning or to truly unpack and co-construct what the unit of inquiry looked like and sounded like. So you probably have a lot of listeners who have a wonder wall or a wall in which they collect learner questions. And a wonder wall is a great start, but a wonder wall is not a learning wall. A wonder wall could be part of a learning wall. And a learning wall, just as my sixth grader said, really is a way that we can improve, I think, and see really big impact on agency inside of the classroom. It could be anchored by a learner question, a concept, a central idea, a general skills that you're trying to flex and develop. And you add and co-construct it with your learners, adding authentic evidence and artifacts that show the process of thinking, right? So we're not just displaying things at the end, but it is a board that gets built together with your learners, and it should contain evidence that your students add to, you're adding to. Of course, just like with everything with inquiry, there is a continuum with that. So the ones that you see on my social media, some of them I'm constructing for adult learners, but I'm using it. So that's the key. It's not a passive tool, but an active tool that we continuously go back to. And use it in our planning process. Our learners should be utilizing it as well. And so if you see some really Pinterest-worthy ones, I'm super curious about those. And I really wonder, how do the learners use it? Is it just one that's teacher-generated and teacher-used? Again, nothing wrong or telling someone that they need to not do it that way, but it's just rethinking the point of a learning wall and how it is that we can have our students truly feel part of the learning, even when we have curriculum that feels really prescriptive or scripted for us. So a really long-winded answer. I'm sure you have some more questions about it.
Yeah, I mean, you hit the nail on the head with it, really. I mean, it needs to be maintained, doesn't it, first and foremost, because I think the students will quickly realize in the classroom that if it's not maintained, then it is just another bulletin board. Mm-hmm. And I've been guilty of doing that myself sometimes. And I want to ask, you know, what, how do you maintain those learning walls together? Do students have roles? Do you give them, you know, agency to put it up at any time? Like, is there any strategies that you can let us know about that would make creating these learning walls more effective?
Yeah, I'd say if you're new to learning walls, don't feel like you have to move things around with your learners. Do that on your own. Grab your laptop and whatever the curriculum you have and sit with the evidence that's there that you've collected during the day and use it to inform your next steps, right? I said that last week, just very casually, and a teacher went like, oh my gosh. And I said, what was that for? What is this heavy sigh? And she said, you don't understand how you telling me that makes me feel like I can go take a risk and go try it because I don't have my learners in my space because I'm not sure how to do it yet. And so I'd say that would be a great start. And then put it in your lesson plans, right? I was working with our educational assistants. I have been working with them all year, and I saw them our very first day back from the winter holidays. And guess what I did? That was the very first thing that I did after we set an intention for our learning session. I said, go grab some sticky notes and go find a critical thought partner and friend and go to the learning wall and talk about what you see and jot down two things on your sticky note. So right away, I invited them to go to the learning wall and use it to be able to retrieve and pick up things that they probably had forgotten, that they maybe overlooked or didn't hear the very first time. So I'd say those are some really critical and easy ways to dip your toe into it. You know, you can have jobs if you'd like to. To me, I think it's overthinking it. It could be quite simple as, you know, we're engaged in a conversation and Matt, you lift up a question. I might say, hey, Matt, jot down that question and go add it over to our learning wall, right? Yeah. So it could be something as simple as that, or knowing the learner questions I have on my wall, Matt, you make a really great connection. And I could say, Matt, go to the learning wall. And can you grab that question over there and attach it to this artifact that we've just added? So simple nudges like that or invitations like that begin to model for our students how it is that they're supposed to go interact with the learning wall. So we need to put it into our lesson plans until it becomes a habit. It's great to have an intention of wanting to use it, but we know an intention is a start. But in order for it to become that habit, we really need to be mindful about making it a practice, just like other things that we want our students to be able to model from us and do eventually independently on their own.
Yeah, and I really like how you you know, you said that it, use it as a tool for reflection for the next part of planning purposes. You know, I think that's something I'm going to do, is sit down, look at the questions we've created, look at what we've gathered, and, you know, let that shift where we're going to go next within the unit or the scope of work. I think that's a really powerful way to use it.
Mm-hmm, definitely. Yeah. Sit in front of your learning wall. It's huge. I had a educator in Tasmania. She actually has a learning wall that's not attached to a wall. She just has a piece of foam board because she's out in the bush a lot working with her kindies. And she said that has been pivotal in her practice because she's able to just kind of give herself a pause in front of her learning wall at the end of the day in order to be able to make next steps or think about it. And some of your listeners might be like, Jess, I can't sit down and do that every day. And I'm not proposing one has to, but we all prepare for the next day in some sort of way. And might that be something that we think of as part of our preparation as well?
Yeah, for sure. And what can go on there? Is it just the opportunities are endless for what could be put on? And is it just what can, you know, connect into what we're like, for example, in an IB school? Would you have it like you've got your statement of inquiry, excuse me, and then you would have, you know, things that are related to that coming up, which spark interest and questions along the way?
Yeah. So, you know, is there an artifact from your provocation that you can put up there because you want your learners to recall or retrieve or reflect on that a little bit later within the unit? Thinking routines are a really great way. Of course, sticky notes, students kind of reflecting, adding questions up there as well. The statement of inquiry is really great. I've seen teachers utilize the inquiry cycle and break up a learning wall within the cycle. And then they add different artifacts based on where it is that they're in the cycle. So there's an intentionality around that and kind of a way for them to make some meaning about what it is that they're unpacking. Yeah, I mean, it really could be anything. I say what I probably would prompt you to as you're thinking about using your learning wall as well is what do you want your learners to retrieve in the long term? And what might be something that helps them recall or remember that, right? So, of course, it depends on the purpose of your learning wall. If there's a bunch of different resources that you want them to go back to or some websites that are like linked by QR codes, those could go on there. Of course, with the littles, photos are really great, although I wouldn't say that you should shy away from photos as well, right? But that question is really key is what do you want your learners to retrieve and what might spark that thinking? Some teachers do a really great job and honestly just take the cover of the book that they read and throw that up on the wall. So that way it becomes an anchoring symbol or an icon for them to go back to later. I know you teach older students, but ask your students, hey, we've engaged in some really amazing research or some really amazing thinking. What do you think we might be able to gather some evidence and see what they say, have them create it or have them rip out something from their journal, right? I'd say, you know, ask our students and they give us some really great ideas. I also really am a big fan of sentence strips and note cards, having those at the ready along with post-its because I can jot down something. Maybe there's a headline or some sort of quote that we saw that I want them to remember a little bit later so I can write that down and throw that up there too. So having those tools handy is also really helpful too because then you can give those to your students and they can do the writing for you.
Yeah, brilliant, brilliant. You almost need to produce like a learning wall pack that we can buy. Hey?
Well, I mean, it's nothing fancy. I don't want people to overthink it. You know, there was a teacher who I was in her classroom recently and all her things in her learning wall were just kind of white and a construction paper and just photocopies of things. And I thought she was doing it really intentionally to not be distracting. And she's like, no, that's just what I had. And again, just like the intentionality about the resources. So it doesn't need to be anything fancy. I want people to just start. I don't want you to overthink about it or find the perfect space or make sure your wall's as big as mine. Just start with something, right? It could be a slide deck. You could use Google Slides and each slide on the slide deck is something that you're adding to the learning wall. I'm currently using Jamboard with a couple of educators right now, but I know Jamboard's going away after this year. So we'll have to kind of find something else, but lots of options, both in person and then a digital, although I prefer the tangible in-person ones.
So I'm just thinking for secondary teachers and, you know, high school and middle school, what would you kind of have like one big learning wall that could be shared by everybody? Or because you know, I'm just thinking about the classroom mm-hmm. setups that mm-hmm. I'm familiar yeah. with. We just have like one big wall at the back. Would you know? Mm-hmm. Would you split it up, or would you just have like a whole one, or would it not matter?
You know, I think it.
Because we have different classes. Sorry, I forgot to add right. that context there. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, so you share a classroom with other teachers. Is that right?
No. So like in my particular setting, secondary and high school teachers will have like maybe five different classes from different year mm. groups. So mm-hmm. how to share that kind of learning yeah. wall space if there's just one wall.
Yeah, so I've seen teachers break it up and then they'll label it because, of course, they have different sections. But if you teach the same subject, it's nice having it in one space because even if I'm in your English class and I'm, you know, at a younger grade level and you also are teaching English to some older students, what's the harm in me seeing what's happening in another grade level, right? Maybe I would make some different connections. So I'd say you probably want to separate it so there's an intentionality. And so that way myself as a learner know where to go to. You know, I think a lot about our students who are most vulnerable or students who are learning, who are emergent bilinguals, right? Learning that second language. Having something that's clear and scaffolded and routine is really important as I'm starting to learn a new language. And so I'd say dividing it up probably would be best. I've seen some teachers also just do some really creative things where they'll take their board, but then they will have butcher paper and then they will be able to unroll and roll back up the butcher paper depending on how it is that they need it. You have your own classroom space, but some teachers move, right, to a library, yeah. to like three different classrooms. So that's been a challenge for them. And so we've talked about being creative with thinking outside of the box. So a butcher paper rolled up is really convenient. And I actually learned another tip from a teacher that I just have to share that she said, you know, she wants to take down things from the learning walls, but she doesn't want to throw them away or recycle them because she knows she might need them later. So she just rolls them up and then puts like a paper clip on it and then just kind of, you know, a quick little label about what it is. And then she just has a bin that has all these rolled up artifacts mm-hmm. that she can go back to later and throw back up when she needs it at a later date as well. So maybe something to, again, yeah, just being really flexible and thinking outside the box is, it's not static, right? It's an active piece that is continuously changing. And, you know, I would also like to say, Matt, and I don't know if this is helpful for you too, when I start a learning wall, I'd probably say 99% of the time it doesn't end up where I had thought. Mm-hmm. And that's because I'm actively attuned and responding to what's not happening and unfolding. So even though I have a vision, I don't let that vision be the thing I have to stick to. And I let that go and I listen and I wait and I collect
artifacts. Which is the fundamental of, you know, inquiry-based learning as well, isn't it? It's kind of a reflection of what's going on there.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's hard. It's hard to do it as teachers. We have the best intentions, right? We feel this weight and pressure and want our learners to leave our spaces more knowledgeable and more independent. And sometimes that more creates a tension and it's hard to let go of that.
All right. So I've got a couple of questions from the listeners, if that's okay, that they've sent in. So there's one from tas_inquiry_journey. And mm-hmm. she's asking, is there a particular book you recommend for starting out with inquiry?
Gosh, how do you even choose one book? I really am a huge fan of Kath Murdoch's work, of course. And so I'd say any of her publications are really some really great starts for sure. And Trevor McKenzie's work, Inquiry Mindset, this is elementary edition, was really transformational for my campus. I saw a huge shift in my campus that I was formerly at when we took that and then we read it together and reflected on what that could look like and sound like. And what I think was really special about both of those books is that you take them and then you transfer the learning and you make your own meaning. So just because those amazing minds propose something to try doesn't mean it's going to work in your context. And what I really love is that in reading those, I didn't see that those were like the checklist things that I had to do. They were a really great guide and suggestion, of course, rooted in rich practice and research, and minds well before them. But I'd love for any of your listeners, whether or not they pick up those books or pick up another one, is when you read a book that has an inquiry stance and mindset and philosophy and approach, think about it within your context and how might it work? How might you transfer the ideas that are being proposed within your context? And that might feel really ambiguous for your learners. I'm so sorry, Matt, but I just feel like it just nods to the fact that inquiry learning works, and we know that conceptual teaching and learning works because there's that transfer of knowledge into other contexts. And so how might we nudge ourselves as learners and inquiry educators too, of looking at the ideas that are proposed and then thinking about how those might look and sound in our practice. And then, of course, connecting with other educators just as yourself to sort and make meaning and look at each other's practice. I'm a really big proponent, as you are, of course, as well, of social media, to be able to have this collective conversation and unpacking and understanding about what is a provocation, just as you've asked, and what might look like and sound like, and how might we shift and rethink about the way that we're approaching teaching and learning in our classroom. So long and winded answer again, but those would be some really great ones if you have listeners who are just getting started on their journey, definitely.
Yeah, I would have recommended similar ones as well. So a great start to get in. But yeah, just to touch on, the social media community, there's a lot of people sharing great content, right, which looks different in every context or setting that they're in. So I think it's important to look at that as well. And then it might, paint a bit more of a brighter picture rather than thinking it has to fit exactly how you've read it in a book. It might look slightly different wherever you are.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Yeah. That's the power of this type of work, isn't it?
Okay. So I've got one last question from Joe, who emailed in. And he says, do you have any advice on motivating high school students to maintain a learning wall?
Yes, I love this question. I was facilitating some virtual sessions through Chapters International last year, and I had several high school teachers. I'd say ask your learners what's meaningful to them, what's helpful for them. And this is not a cop-out. This is regrounding and re-rooting ourselves in what inquiry stance is about. And it is putting the learners back at the center. And our learners might not be able to answer or tell us what it is that's helpful. So that's where we co-construct and offer some suggestions, right, of what this could look like and sound like, right? If we know that we're going to be asking our students to write an essay, let's say, what do they need? What evidence would they need in order for them to feel like they could write that essay or that argumentative piece, right? What could you as the teacher consider collecting and co-constructing as evidence to be able to add to that? So that way, when the students, high school students, are asked to create or write this essay, they see the value in what it is that you co-constructed together. They might think, oh man, he or she's given me the answers, right? So that's probably pretty motivating. But where do the answers come from? It's come from them. So I'd say, asking the students what's really helpful. And I'd say if we are planning with the learning wall in mind, as in using it as that third teacher, as I mentioned before, the students are going to see the value, right? Because we're referencing it and we're using it. I'm also a really big fan of Pooja Agarwal. She has co-authored the book called Powerful Teaching. She's a cognitive scientist and researcher. And she talks about the brain science around retrieval and having protocol and routines that support the retrieval process that we're asking our students to engage in as they're remembering and reflecting on things that we've learned. And so I love to leverage some of the protocols that she references in that book in tandem with a learning wall. So that way students are using it and I have a tangible tool to be able to use alongside that. So I'd say those are some really great starts and things that I've honestly seen high school teachers use and seen a lot of success in that. So hopefully some things to consider. I know the high schoolers, teenagers, man, they make it hard for us, don't they?
They do.
But you know, ask them. They've probably never been asked before.
But you know, great advice, as has been throughout the whole episode. I think you've shared lots of wonderful ideas and experience with the listeners. And you know, it's been really great to get you onto the podcast. Where can people find your work, Jessica? Where's the best place for people to connect? Where can they learn more about what it is that you do?
Yeah, so you can jump on over to my website, leadingwithinquiry.com. There's some resources on there, some sketch notes, blog, of course. But honestly, I share mostly on Instagram. I love the visual nature and storytelling of Instagram to be able to unpack the process. So on Instagram, Twitter, and you can find me at Jess_Vance.edu. Also kind of dabbling into LinkedIn finally. That's a 2024 goal of mine. But yeah, I really encourage anybody who's listening, if you've listened to this podcast and reach out with a question, I can't tell you how many wonderful relationships and connections and partnerships that I've gotten to have with schools and educators because of that platform, because of one question, and how that one question has driven some really great learning and some really amazing connections. So I learned so much from the questions that I get asked as well. So I invite those too.
All right. Well, thank you very much again, Jessica, for taking the time to come on and share your wisdom with our listeners. And it's been a pleasure.
You're welcome. Thank you so much, Matt. And thank you for sharing all of your resources, the transformations that you're doing within your classroom. And, you know, just as I said before, that is something that we can all learn from. So just want to extend some gratitude for you as well.
Thank you. Thank you.
You're welcome. We'll talk to you later.
Well, you have a great day.
Thank you.
And I'll talk to you soon.
That sounds great. Thanks so much.
Thanks for listening to this episode, and I hope you enjoyed it. Your support is incredibly valuable. If you can like and share this podcast and even subscribe, this will be great and help this podcast grow. For Apple Podcast listeners, leaving a review would mean the world to me. And don't forget, you can explore more resources over at inquiryteacher.com or follow me on social media @MattTFletcher. Have a great day, and thanks for all your support.